Welcome back to Native Solidarity News. We just heard a presentation by Gilbert White Duck that was given at the First People's House, one of the institutions at McGill University, that was given a month or so ago. And I hope you got a bunch out of it. I know I did. I was especially impressed by whatever, you know, like, dudes don't often talk about violence against women, and it is super important. It is a problem with our society, with our culture, and if us dudes don't start stepping up to it and admitting that us dudes have a problem with it, then you know, then we're lacking and we are the problem. And so, yeah, I really appreciated that, and I hope y'all did too. So we have a few news items coming up to you now. The first piece comes from the UK Indie Media and from Al Jazeera. And it's in commemoration of January 1st, which is, yes, the Gregorian New Year, New Year's Day. But it's also the 12th anniversary of the uprising of the Zapatista National Liberation Army, or the EZLN, in so-called southern Mexico. January 1st was therefore appropriate for the Zapatistas to launch their other campaign with a 20,000 people demonstration in San Cristobal de los Casas in Chiapas, Mexico. La otra campaña, the other campaign, is also the counterpart to Mexico's election campaign, which is happening this year. The MAC candidate of the other campaign will be Subcommandant Insurgent Marcos, Delegate Zero, which means nobody. The Zapatistas don't want to take control, to have power. They want an anti-capitalist, anarchist society. They want to create a world in which many worlds fit. Delegate Zero will travel around all over Mexico and talk to groups and individuals. The city where he first arrived and where the other campaign started was San Cristobal de los Casas, one of the cities that once was occupied by the Zapatistas when they started their rebellion in 1994. Apparently competing for the attention of Mexico's 13 million indigenous people, President Vicente Fox on Monday began his own tour of the country's indigenous communities. He sounds scared to me, and I think rightfully so. The next piece comes from Indian Country Today. What happens to indigenous people when their colonizers take away everything that they need to survive? They start killing themselves at a rate unsurpassed anywhere in the world. That's part of the Innu people's tragic struggle to retain their land, resources, and traditional lifeways, according to Armand McKenzie, an Innu lawyer representing his people in the human rights conflict spanning two continents and nearly six decades. He says, "Our people have been dispossessed, pushed aside so that mining and hydroelectric companies can come make money off of our land." Nitassinan, the Innu traditional homeland comprising more than 300,000 square miles of tundra, forests, lake, rivers, and valuable mineral deposits on the Labrador-Quebec Peninsula, was never ceded or signed away by treaty to Canada. Innu leaders argue that Canada should have to prove how it claims ownership of Aboriginal lands belonging to people who have lived there for more than 7,500 years. A similar cry is given by the Shawepam in occupied Skequequelt territory, their rallying cry being, "Where is your deed?" Colin Sampson, a sociologist at the University of Essex, who co-authored a landmark report in 2001, Colin Sampson is a sociologist at the University of Essex who co-authored a landmark report in 2001 that shocked the international community. The report, entitled "Canada's Tibet: The Killing of the Innu," revealed that the Innu in Labrador, quote, "suffer the highest rate of suicide on Earth, as one of the world's most powerful nations occupies their land, takes their resources, and seems hell-bent on transforming them into Euro-Canadians." It also condemned Canada's colonial policies, which were designed to force the Innu from their land so that it could be opened to non-native development and coerce them into abandoning the traditional hunting culture to become, quote-unquote, civilized by adopting a sedentary lifestyle in government-built villages and sending their children to residential schools. One of those developments, the controversial James Bay hydroelectric project that flooded vast portions of Innu, Cree, and Inuit lands, resulted in a total disruption of the Innu way of life and blatant violations of their rights. In order to build the project, Canada negotiated a land claims settlement with the Cree and Inuit peoples, but the Innu chose not to participate because the settlement contained provisions to extinguish native ownership to their homelands. Mackenzie says, "This land claim overlapped some of our traditional hunting grounds. And when the land claims settlement was adopted by Parliament, they extinguished the rights of all Indian people to the land." He continues, "Our elders and families went to Parliament and told them it was unfair and unjust, that they had no right to extinguish our rights because we were not part of that settlement. In the meantime, the loss of control over their way of life and the denial of their right of self-determination has had devastating impacts. Innu communities that once thrived by trapping, fishing, and hunting caribou are now suffering social ills common on reservations in the United States. Extreme poverty, pervasive unemployment, increased violence, alcoholism, drug abuse, and the loss of language and cultural skills. Canada's policies towards the Innu have caused deep psychological trauma as well as social and cultural disintegration, resulting in suicide, gas sniffing, physical and sexual abuse, problems practically unknown before they were exposed to Euro-Canadian contact. In November of 2004, the Human Rights Committee reiterated its finding that Canada does not have the right to unilaterally extinguish the rights of Indigenous peoples and specifically asked Canada for information on what it is going to do on what it is going to deal with the case of unilaterally extinguishing the rights of Innu people. The Innu people and international community are waiting for answers. The Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples sets minimum standards for how we will be treated, Mackenzie said. We are now trying to convince Canada that there's a better way to treat Indian people, and we have to see the principles in the Declaration as a guideline in our relationship. That again comes from Indian Country Today. It is, I think it's part of Canadian nationalist pride that Canada is a world leader in mining operations. That is, that around the globe, the majority of mining operations are owned by Canadian-based transnational corporations. So not only do they expropriate in places like Kajapur in Australia, in South America, but also right here, where we can see the Innu, for example, so much diamonds and gold on their land is being just stolen by corporations that give nothing to the communities but disease and social conflict. Conflict diamonds is a big deal, and people think that if they don't come from Sierra Leone, then they're not conflict diamonds. But check, you know, these are not resources, you know, these are stolen goods, that people aren't being paid for and are not being taken, in good faith and are being taken against the will of the people who have been sitting on them for centuries. I don't know what the answer is. Consume less, you know, is a start. Or just be conscious, you know. But that's enough of me soapboxing. I'm just going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with more Native Solidarity News.
I am not your princess, especially for D. Johnson. I am not your princess, sandpaper between two cultures which tear one another apart. I'm not a means by which you can reach spiritual understanding or even learn to do beadwork. I'm only willing to tell you how to make fry bread. 1 cup flour, spoon of salt, spoon of baking powder. Stir. Add milk or water or beer until it holds together. Slap each piece into rounds. Let rest. Fry in hot grease until golden. This is Indian food, only if you know that Indian is a government word which has nothing to do with our names for ourselves. I won't chant for you. I admit no spirituality to you. I will not sweat with you or ease your guilt with fine turtle tails. I will not wear dancing clothes to read poetry or explain hardly anything at all. I don't think your attempts to understand us are going to work, so I'd rather you left us in whatever peace we can still scramble up after all you continue to do. If you send me one more damn flyer about how to heal myself for $300 with special feminist counseling, I'll probably set fire to something. If you tell me one more time that I'm wise, I'll throw up on you. Look at me. See my confusion, loneliness, fear, worrying about all our struggles to keep what little is left for us. Look at my heart, not your fantasies. Please, don't ever again tell me about your Cherokee great-great-grandmother. Don't assume I know every other Native activist in the world personally. That I even know names of all the tribes or can pronounce names I've never heard, or that I'm expert at the peyote stitch. If you ever again tell me how strong I am, I'll lay down on the ground and moan, so you'll see at last my human weakness like your own. I'm not strong, I'm scraped. I'm blessed with life while so many I've known are dead. I have work to do, dishes to wash, a house to clean. There is no magic. See my simple, cracked hands, which have washed the same things you wash. See my eyes, dark with fear in a house by myself, late at night. See that to pity me or to adore me are the same. One cup flour, spoon of salt, spoon of baking powder, liquid to hold. Remember, this is only my recipe. There are many others. Let me rest here, at least.
Welcome back to Native Solidarity News. I'm just going to bring you up to speed on what we've been listening to in the show so far. First we heard from the first Red Wire compilation. The song was Feeling Reserved by War Party. And then we heard a track off of From the Heart, Powwow Songs, by the Whitetail Singers. And then we heard from the album We Will All Sing by the Six Nations Women Singers. And then we heard a couple more tracks off of the Red Wire compilation, in the order of Kill Them by Manic, OS12, and Chili. And then that last spoken word piece was by Christos. It was called I Am Not Your Princess. Red Wire is rad. Once again, their website is www.redwiremag.org. And so we've got a couple more pieces coming up. The first we're going to try to play is from the CBC. It's a short 2-minute piece about a report that was recently released by the RCMP in which they admit neglect in having not shown up to a 911 call when an Aboriginal woman called in saying that her husband was drunk and was trying to kill her, and they didn't show up. They say it's not because she's Aboriginal, but we do know that that's a pattern. If you want to find out more information about this pattern, which we call patriarchal colonialism, you can check the website sistersinspirit.ca. So we're just going to go right to that piece now, and then we'll be right back.
The lack of attendance in this particular case was clearly an error.
Superintendent Marty Chaliak makes it clear the police response to Brenda Moorside's last cry for help wasn't good enough. At RCMP K Division headquarters in Edmonton today, Chaliak revealed some of the results of an administrative review into the tragedy.
I can clearly say that we erred in not attending the residents personally.
CKUT is looking for a
telephone. However, that was an inappropriate response.
Internal RCMP documents obtained by CBC show Morside's boyfriend had a violent history with several convictions. They show the victim also made a previous call to police to complain about an assault. Even though her last 911 call was made on February 13th, it wasn't until February 25th that police found her body inside the home. Police have since charged a man with second-degree murder. Morside's son watched the news conference in his Edmonton apartment on television. Craig Flatter says describing the response as an error leaves him feeling cold.
It sounded kind of dismissive to me because his error resulted in the death of my mother.
Flatter says he wants to see a fatality inquiry so the public can see exactly where the system failed his mother. He's getting support on that position from Jan Reimer with the Alberta Council of Women's Shelters.
It's fine to have internal reviews, but we also believe there needs to be a public review, and that's another way to help affect systemic change to make things happen.
Police say it's up to the provincial government to order a fatality inquiry. In the meantime, Superintendent Cheliak says an internal investigation is continuing into the RCMP member who handled the response to the 911 call. He also says as a result of the tragedy, the force is making changes to its family violence policies. Gareth Hampshire, CBC News, Edmonton.
So that again was a CBC report. Oh, great. The RCMP are investigating themselves. Totally. We just heard, a few months ago, the Stonechild Inquiry was released, which investigated the murder of Neil Stonechild by police who abandoned him in freezing weather, and he died, as have, I believe, a half dozen other men. In the Saskatchewan area, they did an internal investigation, and the officers responsible for Neil Stonechild, a kid dying, they were fired. They were never charged with murder. They were let go, and they're appealing the decision. What kind of an internal investigation are we going to have in this case? Maybe another slap on the wrist? Maybe they'll be fired. Will they be charged? Probably not. It's ridiculous, you know? The police investigating themselves, whatever, you know? They're basically the strongest gang in the country, and they've got the courts to back them up. But maybe that's just my opinion. So we've got one more piece of news coming from Australia. It's compiled from articles by the Australian Daily Telegraph and Sydney Indie Media. Armed with tough new powers, Australian police have made a series of arrests and seized a car following an attack on two detectives in a central western town in New South Wales. Extra police were called in after the cops were attacked by a mob and a police car set alight early January 1st. One officer suffered a suspected broken jaw and the other facial injuries when they stopped a suspected stolen car in West Dubois. An unmarked police car and the stolen vehicle were both torched. Nine people have so far been arrested over the incident, and far more expected over the next few days. The authority to confiscate cars was one of a raft of new police powers rushed through New South Wales Parliament in emergency session following last month's Cronulla racial riots. These riots were initiated by white racists against Arabic immigrants. In response, hundreds of immigrants took to the streets in self-defense. These legal provisions are similar to the ones already available to the police under the Terrorism Police Powers Act, except that a perceived threat of terrorism need not be present. The new laws provide special powers to the police, including the ability to authorize an area as a quote-unquote target area. A targeted area can be any size. Within a target area, police have the power to cordon off a specific area, set up roadblocks, and to stop cars and pedestrians from entering the target area. People caught within the target area may be searched, including their cars and anything within a person's possession or control. They may be legally compelled to give their names and to provide proof of their names. Not only can people be prevented from entering a target area, they may also be prevented from leaving a targeted area. The police may prevent a person from leaving a targeted area if it's reasonably necessary to do so to avoid a risk to public safety or to the person's own safety. The lockdown area may be cordoned off or roadblocks for 2 days by the police and without reference to a court. Holy police state. Just wait. There's new... an article came out a few days ago that Canada is again working on having a national ID initiated, and we see in the U.S. the Patriot Act. The police, totally, they're our friends. I feel incredibly safe.